This is Icon Art Radio. Bill Teeple, Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, here we are. Take it away, Donna.
Well, I found this quote. Last night was an odd Thursday when we were talking about creating... No, what was the topic again?
Clearing the creative slate
to allow fresh ideas to emerge. And I used a lot of quotes from Robert, and none of us knew how his last name was supposed to be pronounced. It's spelled like the French Henri, H-E-N-R-I. He was an American painter in the early part of the 20th century, mainly known for being a very wonderful art teacher in New York and in Philadelphia. Some people pronounce his name Henri, Robert Henri or Henry. Anyway, he's the guy who I'm going to be quoting. And one of the things that he said about people's, well, life in general, not just art, is superficially there is negligence, but deep down in people there is love and craving for the beautiful. There are many who go through their whole lives without ever knowing when they have liked or what they have liked.
Wasn't there more? Wasn't there something that people... I guess, okay.
No, the something more was, it was your commentary after I read the quote earlier.
Well, it seemed like there were some other permutations of knowing whether you knew.
Oh, that was the first quote. The other quote that was...
Well, that's the one that got us all confused, but do you want to read that one
too? Shall I read that one? Because it's sort of related to this one. The other quote, which is a really sort of language-twisting one, very few people know what they want. Very few people know what they think. Many think and do not know it. And many think they are thinking and are not thinking.
Yes, I like that one a lot.
They're actually both related to each other. You know, how genuine is our experience and how programmed is our experience? Yeah.
Well, it reminded me, the first quote that you read second, the second quote that you just read reminded me how long it was. I mean, how far into my life it was before I really began to recognize what I liked. Because I really had spent a lot of time trying to identify the criteria in something that would tell me whether I was supposed to like it or not, instead of checking to see whether I liked it or not. And in fact, I always got in trouble if I just went with whether I liked it or not, because a lot of the stuff that was being thrown at me in school, I didn't like. And I was required to like it, or at least, you know, deal with it. So I spent a lot of time, kind of ignoring my own likes and dislikes. And then there was a phase where, and I distinctly remember it in college, where I was able to just totally like or not like anything I wanted. And it was this sort of wild sense of freedom. Then I discovered that people's feelings are always getting hurt if you just say you don't like something. And so I kind of consigned that freedom just to movies, because I figured, look, I paid money for this, and if I don't like it, they're putting it out here for us to, you know, take it or leave it, kind of. So I should be able to say anything I want about a movie without hurting anybody's feelings. And that lasted for a long time. I felt that way until I had been in, you know, the Hollywood environment long enough so that I've now knew too many people whose feelings would be hurt if I didn't like a film, too. So I began kind of censoring that also. But it all shows how complicated it is in a cultural context to actually simply like or not like something.
Or know what you like.
Or know what you like. Because it isn't so much even what you say to other people about what you like and don't like, where you could hurt their feelings, but sometimes it's even within yourself, alone in your, you know, I find myself even now at this age of my life responding to things based on what I think I should, what I think it's cool to like or not cool, or if I'll maybe like something and think, oh man, I can't admit that I like that because everybody will think I'm really ignorant or stupid or corny or whatever.
You're tasteless.
Sometimes I, like when I go visit my mother in New Jersey, she likes to watch very sentimental Hallmark movies on television. And normally here, I wouldn't watch those movies. But when I'm sitting there with my mom, I can get pulled into those kind of movies, totally over-the-top, corny, sentimental movie, and sit there and cry. The tears are streaming down my face. It's moving me so much. Mm-hmm. And feeling at the same time very embarrassed that I'm glad none of my friends are there to see me respond that way. Yeah. Why? You know, why yeah. am I not open about the fact that a movie like that can touch my heart, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess I would feel that those movies are designed to make you cry, mm-hmm. and they're designed by experts, and it's not at all surprising. You know, that's their stock in trade, really, is the schmaltzy aspect mm-hmm. of it. But to like that is fine. It's a question of also whether you value it, because you can like things and not value them. Mm-hmm. I like chocolate cake, but I don't value it. I'd be much happier if I never bumped into one again.
Well, those movies, though, and even something like a commercial on television that's a little puppy dog or a child who's, you know, pulling on your heartstrings, I can respond to those, too. They can make me cry, even though a part of my mind is going, oh, they're really twisting, you know, they're really using mm-hmm. this to get me to buy this
cheap
product.
Cheap shots, right.
Cheap shot. But at the same time, physically, I'm feeling my heart opening. And that feels good,
well,
and that's a healthy thing, and I'm appreciating that.
And, mm-hmm. and I think we have to be able to discriminate what's going on and how we're being manipulated. And the more wakeful you are in it, the more valid every aspect is. Mm-hmm. We can't, you know, the guy's trying to sell a product. I mean, he's trying his best. And we recognize it. We see it. We got our eyes open. But at the same time, these sentimental responses, which are really archetypal stories drawn right out of all the epic poems of all time, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. are true things that touch mythic stories within us, archetypal patterns. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to have that enlivened in ourselves and to recognize that's a human story.
Yeah. And it's slightly disgusting to think that people would be taking these archetypes and using them to sell soap.
Not only slightly, it's disgusting.
Well, and
infuriatingly outrageous.
And there's a you know, the in writing guidelines at this point in history, cliches are avoided like the plague. But there are a lot of cliches that became cliches because they moved a lot of people. A sunset, for example. You know, you don't use that as a metaphor in a piece of writing anymore because it's just a total cliche. And yet,
but it could be the most radical and thing to use it today because it's so cliche.
Yeah.
So it depends on if you can really hit the peak of hipness by doing it right at the right moment.
Yeah. But the truth of it is, pretty much everybody, no matter how jaded they are and how hip and cool they are, if they go outside and see a spectacular sunset, they're going to be awestruck by it, no matter how many sunsets they've seen before. It's something that's real.
I know, and I deal with this a lot in this field, is there's the appropriated and acquired and established hip outlook, mm-hmm. and then there's what we all spontaneously respond to.
Yeah. Also, you know, what happened as I was listening to you talk about the sunset is that the sunset became jargonized, not through any fault of yours, but in a sense we suddenly began to lump all sunsets together and say sunsets. Oh, that's another sunset. Mm. It's like saying, oh, well, that's just a novel. It's just a novel, you know, how broad a spectrum, you know, would you like to deal with here? And that's because at the same time that sunsets are something that we see over and over and over, we never see the same one twice mm-hmm. exactly, and it becomes an acquired taste in addition to being something that's, you know, obviously beautiful to nearly everyone if they haven't looked at one lately and there's a good one that comes along or a dramatic one that comes along. But also, you know, you start getting into the subtleties, the refinements, all the different ways that a sunset can be interesting, and you could just as well say that you know, like the Eskimos maybe have 20 words for snow, you know, students of sunsets could have 1,000 words for sunset. Mm-hmm. And within each of those sunset categories, there would be another 1,000, you know, variations and gradations.
I was watching a sunset with somebody one time, and she actually said, "That is so beautiful. It looks just like a postcard."
Yes. Well, I'm fond of admiring how realistic they are. I was walking on the hill east of campus, east of the Waterworks Park, with my friend Paul a year or two ago, and we noticed the light on the trees in front of us was getting strange looking, so we turned around, and we happened to be on a hilltop, and we were looking at this sunset, and we realized that in the sky, if you just fiddled with your vision the tiniest little bit, you could put the horizon way up in the sky, and we were really looking at a coastline, and it looked like the Pacific Ocean with an amazingly convoluted shoreline and islands, and you know, is that Catalina? It could be. And oh, the channel, you can just make out the Channel Islands up to the right. And we started doing that, and then we began to notice other things about it, and we stood there examining and discussing the subtleties of that sunset until it was gone. And it was at least half an hour before the sun went down that we began exploring it, and it was just incredible. I mean, we just stood there awestruck watching this endless evolution of geology in the sky that was completely unexpected. And then it turned into a light show, and people were walking on the path back and forth, and they'd come to us and say, "What are you looking at?" And we'd say, "Look, you can see the ocean." And we'd say, "What? What are you talking about?" But all you had to do was give it your attention for a while, and it would command, you know, layers of you know, new, revealing new layers.
So. See, that's the key, I think. How often in modern life, with all of our hustling and bustling all the time, do we take the time to just, in a settled way, tune into something and see as much as we can see? I mean, this whole thing about being programmed to like what, even in like letters to the editor in the newspaper, when people are commenting on some political issue or some community issue, very frequently they're just gut responses that are not researched at all. Someone's just, you know, offended because the person had a different opinion than they did. And when they state their opinion, it's obviously an opinion that has been cultured in them because of their family or their, you know, political background or education or whatever, and this is what you're supposed to like. This is the way you're supposed to be. And what is this other person saying this other thing for? Everybody knows that's ridiculous. It's we're so unconsciously programmed in so many ways, all of us are really, that very few people take the time to do what you were just describing and really see something innocently and get and have an innocent response, or research something deeply that you don't understand and say, this person has a different opinion. Like we were talking about last week with art criticism, in anything in life, if someone says something that is very different from the way we think, it would be a highly valuable thing to research that and see how somebody can have that opinion that's so different from ours.
And yeah.
And usually what we watch ourselves doing is a knee-jerk reaction. You know?
Yeah.
You don't even want to watch yourself doing it, but
yeah.
you do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's just, this is what I say as a response to that stimulus, yeah. almost.
Mm-hmm. If you don't agree with me, then your position is stupid.
Right, yeah.
And yet, you know, I know you're not stupid, and so I'm really actually should be curious as to why someone who isn't stupid would have an opinion that isn't the same as mine, because obviously I'm not stupid.
Well, and people, this always baffled me throughout my life, because I have a tendency to want to see things from many different angles,
yeah.
and so whenever I was with someone who was criticizing something else, and often the criticism was of somebody or something they didn't know much about. We'd be watching television and somebody would come on the air and that person would say, that guy is a jerk, you know, and would just, without being basing it on anything. And my tendency would be to say, well, look at it from that person's angle, the way that person was brought up, the society they came in. Obviously, they would feel differently about this thing than you do. And it always surprised me that the person who had made that comment was very offended by what I said, even though I wasn't taking the other person's side against them, I didn't think. I was just trying to broaden the perspective so that it was, and yet...
You were not taking their complaint seriously.
Yeah, I think that's, if someone is criticizing or complaining something about something, it makes them feel better if their friends also...
Yeah, a lot of it is group dynamics. A lot of it is we, there's this, we like this, and and my crowd, we all like this, and we don't like that. And and we think we've emerged out of that from high school, but we really haven't. It's still...
Well, and I remember when, at one point in, after college, things started going better for me in my life, and some of my friends became alienated from me, because... As I became happier, I wasn't as interested in complaining with them. And they'd say, boy, you know, this is such a pain. I hate it when this happens. And I'd say, yeah, that's too bad. You know, hey, you want to go to a movie? And I'd say, no, didn't you hear what I just said? Because they wanted to do 10 minutes of, yeah, I agree, it stinks, and it's all a big pain, and it's a conspiracy, and they're all against us, or whatever. And because I wasn't interested in... you know, complaining for 20 minutes, it meant that I wasn't taking them seriously. And, you know, that's part of the social pressure that keeps people in line with each other.
Well, we all want to be valued for who we are and what we think. And there's some bottom line part, I think, of all of us that really is concerned about whether what we believe and treasure is actually truthful and not a delusion. And so there's a little insecurity level about being spontaneous and honest about what we really like and what we really think, because we're afraid we might make a mistake that that matters, you know, that matters socially or that matters cosmically or whatever.
Well, and we have this sort of inescapable pressure from the world of thinking, whether it's the, you know, parents thinking or in school or schools thinking or society thinking. All this thinking kind of piles up on the individual and leaves you with this unshakable notion that you have to be thinking in order to get through the day. You've got to be constantly thinking all of this stuff. And I really don't think that's true. I think there's, you know, kids are not thinking all day long about they're just reacting. And as you acquire knowledge, reactions, even the very spontaneous ones, become much more, you know, appropriate and much more in context. It's not necessary to be, you know, on your on guard, you know, on your best behavior every moment of the day in order to behave well.
Well, and it's kind of a pacifier, I think, this kind of use of the intellect, because if you can explain something, in a, I mean, just go anywhere, airports, cafes, anywhere, and you will hear people having these deep conversations about things that maybe 10 minutes later they'll just forget about, because they you can, it's easy to get caught having a... conversation about some particular issue that you don't normally aren't very interested in, but in the context of talking about it with your friends, suddenly you find yourself being very passionate about that because the act of thinking and discussing it and putting your attention on that somehow...
Well, language has its own momentum.
Yeah, and it, it makes you feel like bigger in some way.
And also, all of this explaining really is after the fact. You know, all everything the intellect does happens after the notion has been perceived, you know, by intuition, really. It's not that we think things through and come to conclusions and then say eureka. It's more that we're sitting there and there's nothing happening at all, and we say eureka, and then we look around and try and explain it. And I think it would, people would be, you know, helped considerably in life if we taught something like that in school. Mm-hmm. You know, that thinking things through is a good way of understanding something afterwards, and intellectualizing is a good way of defining a question. But the actual movements of thought and motivation and activity come spontaneously, and they come from intuition and not as a result of having thought from A to Z.
Well, also, we live in a culture in this country where a lot of people are not particularly comfortable with silence in a social situation. You find in other parts of the world, you'll find more respect for that, you know, people sitting and eating a meal and completely focusing on the food and not covering up with this rapid conversation the whole time they're eating a meal, and other just, you know, gaps in conversation. People can be having a conversation and suddenly there's a long gap, and I know even myself, I will tend to fill in that gap. If I'm in a conversation with people and there's a big gap, I will assume that nobody can think of anything to say and it's feeling a little bit awkward, and so I'll jump in and say something, because in my world, most people I know are a little awkward with silence. Mm. And it's a healthy thing, I think, if people are more, I wish I was actually more comfortable with silence in a social situation.
I find that when there's a big gap in the conversation, if everybody just accepts it or ignores it, because it isn't really a gap in anything other than the conversation, that it out of the gap is where the things that you would have forgotten to say, you know, will come up. If there was something you actually wanted to mention, as long as the momentum of the conversation is going, that may never come to mind. But if there is a minute of silence, that's when, you know, something real actually happens.
And something that's more, you know, you can just appreciate the atmosphere or...
Oh, ladies and gentlemen.
The spontaneous...
We forgot to turn off our cell phones.
We did. I can't even find
it. Just for the sake of form and function, I'll turn mine off too, even though it didn't ring.
I can't even get at it.
Well, we'll spend the last few minutes of the show discussing Bill's cell phone.
See, even the cell phone couldn't stand any gap of silence in me.
I hate cell phones. I hate people that leave their cell phones.
I know. Why can't we have telegraphs like we used to? If you had a message coming, it would come in down at the train station and someone would come running up to the house with a piece of paper.
I actually lived in a place one time where I wasn't even able to get mail at my residence, and so I had to have it sent to general delivery at the post office. And it was one of my favorite things of the day to go and have a little conversation with the woman postmaster, and there were the little cubby holes in the wall, and I could tell when I walked into the place whether there was a letter in my little cubby hole, and it made the whole, it was still before email, and people actually wrote actual letters, and there was something charming about that. I know when I wrote letters to people, I put a lot more thought into them than I do when I'm sending an email to people.
But people get emails from me and people didn't get letters from me.
That's right. That's right. I used to...
I love it as an ideal art form. But
I used to write really, really good letters once in a blue moon. And now I write very mediocre emails all the time.
Well, no, I have to say, you actually sometimes write spectacular emails.
Oh, well,
thank you. Your emails tend to be more like genuine epistles on something than most people's emails.
Look at the epistles of Alan. Well, I do collect some of my emails, actually. where someone has asked me a good question, then I've managed to get a good answer. And now with the internet, I'll go and confirm stuff before I send the email, make sure I'm not just making it all up. Sometimes I can't tell.
Well, you have to get into any art form. It's, again, going back to our original topic of knowing what you actually like and what you think you should like.
We're supposed to hate cell phones and the internet because it's cooler to like little niches with handwritten letters.
Or the other way around, you know. It's like my mother doesn't like email. She's 86 years old. She's actually a pretty modern woman, but she really doesn't. She did email for a while. She really didn't like feeling obligated to turn on her computer every day, even if she didn't feel like it. Because somebody would call and say, hey, you didn't respond to my email, and think that she was
offended. What a great way to get people to call, though.
And so she, anyway, she feels always apologetic to everyone else in the family that she doesn't like. I'm really sorry I don't like email, she'll say, and feeling that she has to justify the fact that she doesn't like it.
And it seems like she probably wouldn't dislike it, though, if she could overcome the feeling of obligation to turn on her computer every day.
Partly, no, but she also doesn't like the look of it. She likes the feel of a piece of paper in her hand, and she actually does have friends who write her letters.
Well, and of that generation, there still is a tradition of letter writing.
Yeah.
I think that the younger generation of today, probably many of them have never written a letter and
that's
never will.
True.
Although I have to say, my son Dane, who's 28 years old and very technologically hip, when he was living in Arizona in this little cabin, he sent postcards, most of which he had done drawings on and calligraphy and everything, to all of his friends. And he was complaining, he came to visit last week, and he was complaining that nobody, not one single person, sent him a piece of mail in response to these postcards.
This is what I'm saying.
He really wanted.
But Dane is unique.
Yeah.
And the rest of them are
the rest of them are all the same.
Right.
Excuse me.
This is the amazing thing. Little known facts.
Well, this seems like an appropriately disconnected show for the day after New Year's.
Yeah, I think so.
So with that, we will disconnect.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.